off that story. And so to say, I own it. This happened. This is what I learned. And here's the new ending. The new ending is, I'm going to go out of town and do the work I love because I feel like it's important and it's who I am and it's part of who I am. And I'm going to do a better job spending more time with my kids, explaining why my work is important to me and what I do, and less time making casseroles and picking out outfits. And I'm going to be so thankful to Steve every time I can show him gratitude in a meaningful way, because I would never have this career and this work if I didn't have him. I really wouldn't. I mean, I just wouldn't. He believed in me when I didn't believe in it. When I was like, I don't think anyone's going to want to talk about shame. He's like, you just need to keep talking. You just need to keep talking. But I couldn't get to that revolution, that really, and it's not an evolution. It's not evolutionary change. It's not incremental change. It's smack you upside the head, turn you upside down, and shake you by your ankles change. When you start saying, here are the lessons, and here's how I'm going to put those back in my life. So what I'm going to do when we get back from break is I want to walk through what I think are the four hardest rumbles that we have in the SFDs. I want to talk about grief. I want to talk about forgiveness. I want to talk about generosity and extending it toward other people. We'll talk about the big things we have to tackle in the rumble.
The program continues with session two, Rising Strong with Difficult Rumbles.
First session, we talked a little bit about the rising process, and we talked about the reckoning, the rumble, the revolution, how we need to own our stories if we're going to write a different ending. What I want to do with you in this second session is talk about some of the big, hard rumble topics that we have to dig into. And we're going to start with a topic that this is, I would vote this topic the most likely to piss people off of all the topics I start with. I swear I'm nervous about telling the story because I never have told the story I told the first session about missing my flight. And this story has some similar themes to it. And you're going to start to see a pattern. So I'm literally, as I'm standing up here, thinking, think of a different story that doesn't make you look like you've really got terrible problems in this area. But I can't think of any because that's my stuff. So we'll do a story, Anne. One of the things that I have seen in the past 5 years as I've spent all this time in organizations is a value that I would say 65%, maybe 70% of organizations have some version of this value in a value statement. And it is the assumption of positive intent. Are y'all familiar with this? For those of you who have not heard this term before, it is the value of, if something doesn't work out right, I will assume the most positive thing I can assume about the situation. This is really common to see. Big companies have this. And as a core, and no one does it, and everyone wonders why. They ask me, why don't people assume positive intent? And my answer is because assuming positive intent is the outcome of two other really big steps that y'all aren't talking about at all. So one of the big rumbles that we have to do is around generosity. And so here's my story. How many of you have read Rising Strong? So this is chapter 6 in Rising Strong. This is my story on sewer rats and scofflaws. Yes. So this story sadly begins just how the other story began, with me saying yes to an event that I did not want to go to. This was an interesting experience because this was a group of people who said, can you come speak at this event? And I said, I cannot. And their response in email was, wow, I guess it's easy to forget the little people who supported you before you were famous. Wow. Right. I heard a no shit in the audience. So that is hard for me because one of the big shame triggers I have from growing up is shame around being high maintenance. So how many of you grew up in families where high maintenance was a shaming thing? Yeah, so I grew up in a family where if we were on a road trip and you had to pee, you could hold it. Or you get the very least, pick something on the right side of the road. We're not ever crossing over the freeway to go to the bathroom. Just being high maintenance itself was you needed to be easy. And you needed to do extraordinary things, but they needed to look effortless. Which is a total setup, right? And so I was like, oh my God, I don't want to be someone who forgets the little people. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm sorry. No, you're right. I think I can come. And then about a month later, they emailed again and said, okay, this is where you're going to be staying. It's kind of a cabin camping thing. And your roommate is going to be this person. And I was like, whoa, did someone say roommate? Because I don't do roommates. So I emailed back and said, oh, I'd really prefer my own place. If it's a money issue, we'll figure out the difference or something. The email back was, so are you needing special treatment in order to join us? I was like, somebody borrowed tapes from my family. So my response was, no, not at all. Roommate's great. So I get to this place and I get my key and I'm going to my room and, you know, of course saying the huge prayer, like, God, let me be there first. Let me be there first. So at least you can pick the bed and kind of set up and, you know, stake the claim. And of course, when I get there, I'm like, hello, hello. Shit. And I walk in, I'm pulling my legs and I'm like, hey. And there's a woman sitting on a love seat in this room eating a cinnamon roll that's like this big. And she's like, hey. And I'm like, hey, I'm Brene. And she introduced herself and she's nice to meet you. And I said, yeah. She's like, I shake your hand, but I'm really sticky. And then she held the cinnamon roll in her mouth and wiped her hands on the love seat. And she took the cinnamon roll out and she said, it's not our love seat. I was like, oh my God. I was getting dizzy. I was like, oh my God. And I don't know even what we said for the next couple minutes, but then she took the last bite and then she found a non-swiped area on the couch and did her hands again. So there was like visible icing on the couch. And I was like, I said, I'll get you a napkin. And so I went to the little kitchenette thing and I got a napkin. I came back and she wasn't there. She had moved to the little porch and then I smelled cigarette smoke. And I was like, no. And she was smoking. And I know I can smell smoke. I'm the non-smoker. I smoked for 15 years. I'm the non-smoker that's like a table for two as far from smoking as possible. Now there's no smoking in restaurants, so it's easier. But I miss smoking every day of my life. I literally have a Bic pen in my car that I smoke in case like a really good rock and roll song comes on. Like I have to have a cigarette in my hand while I'm driving if there's a good song. So I was like, excuse me, I know this is a non-smoking room, but I think this is a non-smoking property. And she's like, what are they going to throw us out? I was like, what is happening? I was like, okay, I'll be right back. I'm going to run to the front desk. So I took my luggage and I went back to the front desk. I said, I'm going to have another room. They're like, we're sold out. I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? So I end up staying the night with her in the room. I did the first talk in the morning. I'm in the airport and I just remember standing there holding my bag waiting. And I remember every single person who walked by me, I had a thought about. Like, oh my God, are you seriously still wearing those jeans? Like, you're going to let your kid eat those two candy bars before they get on our flight? That's perfect. Oh my God, are you bringing those greasy ass french fries onto this flight? The whole row is going to, like, everyone that walked by, I was just, was like, you did not want to be the person who walked in front of me. I had like the most searing, critical thought about every person. I was like, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? Because one of my big flags is self-righteousness. And so I know that when I'm in self-righteousness, something's wrong, which is so bad because I love the way that feels. I do. I love the way it feels. It's good. It's right. It's like a pig in mud. You're like, ooh, I'm better than everybody. It's good. Except that the hard thing about doing what I do for a living is that when you study shame, you know that, ooh, I'm better than everyone and I am worthless and not as good as anyone are two sides of the same coin. So I know when I get into self-righteousness and I'm better than people, which happens often in the airport, I know that something's wrong. So I'm like, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I'm like, I don't know. So I call Diana, my therapist, and I'm like, I need an appointment when I get back from this trip. So I have an appointment the day after I land. So I get home, I go see Diana, and I'm in the middle of the spiritual awakening. And I'm like, this whole like spiritual, God, wholehearted crap is awesome. Like loving God, woohoo. The sewer rats and the scofflaws, I hate. And I will never stop hating them for as long as I live. And she's like, wow. Like, she didn't even say, like, how are you yet? I was just, that was my whole thing. I'm going to spiritually awaken while hating these people over here. And that's going to be part of my new theology. And I bet you I could put together a big-ass church. How many of y'all are coming to my church? Right. So she's like, what is a sewer rat and scofflaw? And I'm like, sewer rats, haven't you seen the movie Flushed Away? And she goes, and I can see her, she's like, no, I haven't. Because then she had grandkids. And I was like, Flushed Away, it's like this fastidious rat who's like the butler in this really big mansion in London. And he's always clean, he's super tidy and super respectful. And the family goes on vacation and he like is a little naughty. He drives like Barbie's Corvette and he does some things, but he's so nice. But one day, while the family's on vacation, a sewer rat comes up through the toilet into the house. And this guy is terrible. He's got on this denim jacket and boots with the hole, his feet are sticking out of him. He eats food on the couch. He poops on the rug. He wrecks the Barbie car. And then in the end, he flushes my good rat down the toilet. You know, and then my good rat goes and learns that he needs to let go of control and all that crap that they do. But let's talk about the sewer rat pooping all over the nice people's house. And I said, I do not like the sewer rats in life. I don't like those people and I do not like the scofflaws. And she's like, okay, so what's, I got sewer rat is, you know, the chubby mouse with the bad jacket and the, you know, pooping on the floor. What's the scofflaw? And I said, the scofflaw, like a scofflaw, like that person who always makes, not only makes fun of the rules, but makes even more fun of people who follow the rules. I'm like, the scofflaws, like I hate the scofflaws. And she's like, what's an example? And I can think of this great example. It's like that friend, like you're going to the beach with your friends and your friend has this boyfriend who's a total scofflaw. You rent a buggy. This is a true story. You rent a buggy at the buggy shop on the beach that says, please keep your feet in the buggy. And he's driving the buggy and he's got his foot out and, you know, and you're like, hey, dude, put your foot in the buggy. And he's like, oh, Brene's like the buggy police. And then he runs into the curb and cracks his ankle open. And then he's in the ER and you're in the ER instead of being at the beach. And all your friends are like, oh, I feel so bad that Mike cracked his. And you're like, uh-uh, don't feel bad at all. Do y'all know that person, the scofflaw, who always makes fun of the rules and then the people follow him? It's like, so I hate the sewer rats and I hate the scofflaws. And that's final. I'm not open to being moved there. And she said, well, let's talk about, what was your roommate's name? I'm like, we're just going to call her Icing Swiper. And she said, I'm a little uncomfortable with that, but Icing Swiper. Do you think Icing Swiper was doing the best she could? Do you think Icing Swiper was just kind of doing the best she could? And I was like, I couldn't even respond. I can barely respond now. I'm like, hell no. No. And she said, why do you think that? And I said, no, she's not doing the best she can. If that's her best sucks. She's not doing the best she can. And Diana said, do you think it's possible? Do you believe people are doing the best they can? And I was like, no, I think people suck is what I think most of the time. And I do not think, and she goes, I said, okay, wait, really and truly, I know you're a therapist. You know, I get it. You're great at that. Do you really believe people are doing the best they can? And she literally went like this. I do. And you know what? I love her. She is a very important person in my life. I said, you know, well, I think that's awesome for you. And so I'm going to ride off on my frickin' unicorn now, because our time is up. And so it was the first time I'd ever worked with her where I thought, I'm never coming back here. And I was dead serious. Like, we have a philosophical fundamental difference of opinion about human nature that's going to make working together not possible. So I leave there and I go straight to the Wells Fargo by my house and I'm in line. And in front of me is a woman who's probably in her mid-80s, and she moves up to the teller, and I can see that she's really worked up and really upset. I can see the teller, young guy, trying to really calm her down. And then she said, no, that is not the right balance. I want to see a manager right now. And so this young guy goes and gets a manager, and he brings the manager back. And this young guy's African-American. The manager is also African-American. And she goes, do you have another type of manager? And I was like, for all white people, Jesus, what is happening? So this manager is able to get her away. I'm like, oh God. So I walk up and I look at this guy and I'm like, do you think people are doing the best they can? And I'll never forget it. And he said, yeah. I mean, I think for by and large, yeah. And I said, did you see what just happened? And he's like, yeah. And I said, you know, and he looked at me, gave me the look like, oh, my white liberal ally friend, don't teach me about what just happened. But I was like, seriously, like, he's like bunny scary for people. And I think she got panicked. And I was like, wow. And he's like, are you a psychiatrist? I said, no, I'm a researcher. And he said, no, I'm just asking because I was in Afghanistan for 2 tours and I came back and I saw a psychiatrist. My wife had an affair with my best friend while I was deployed. And it's just, these are the kind of questions a psychiatrist asks you. And I was like, yeah, probably. They're my people a little bit. And he's like, yeah, I actually think people are doing the best they can. He said, I think people get afraid and people do stupid things. But yeah, I was like, oh God, this is why he's wounded, because he's got the wrong belief system here. And so I get home and I'm like, I will do whatever it takes to disprove this. And so I start interviewing. I literally apply through human subjects. I start interviewing people, and I interview a lot of people I've already interviewed for the wholehearted research. Simple question. Do you think people are doing the best they can? It's hard, and I can tell you that patterns emerge right away. People who believe that people are doing the best they can are slow to answer and apologetic. They always say to me in interviews, you know, I'm sorry, I know it sounds naive, but I actually think people are doing the best they can. I mean, like, I actually do. I know that's the wrong answer, or, you know. People who do not believe people are doing the best they can are not hesitant at all. They're like, no way. Hell no, under no circumstances are people doing the best they can. So I think this is really interesting. And so then I start to see another pattern, because I'm back in the old research participants, and I start to see the people who I have labeled in my data as wholehearted are overwhelmingly people who believe that people are doing the best they can. And people who struggle the most with perfectionism and control are people who are saying no. But I am going to dig deeper, because I know that is not true. So I asked Steve one night, do you think people are doing the best they can? And I thought it was just going to be a quick conversation, but it takes him like 15 or 20 minutes. And I'm doing other things. I come back and he says to me, I don't know if people are doing the best they can, but I know my life is better when I move through it assuming that people are doing the best they can. Which was profoundly moving, but still filed under bullshit personally for me. I thought I was smart. I still didn't believe it. Then I'm on my way to see, what's his name? John Mayer? Yes, in concert. With a friend that Steve had kind of set me up with. Steve knew her. Her kids saw Steve. My husband's a pediatrician. And he's like, I met this mom. She kind of reminds me of you. Maybe I should hang out. And so our husbands are sitting in the front seat. We're sitting in the back seat. And I was like, okay, question for you. Do you think people are doing the best they can? And she's like, shit, no, no. Like, okay, like, right. And she goes, the perfect example of this, she had just had a kid. The perfect example of this is breastfeeding. She's like, look, here's the thing. If you're not going to breastfeed for a year or two when you have a baby, don't have a baby. Make the choice. If you don't want to be all in as a parent. And there I am, transforming into that chubby little rat with a blue jean jacket and holes in my boots. I'm like, what? And she's like, yeah, I mean, like, come on. Like, year, 2 years. You know, people who say, I can't do it for that long because I got an infection or I'm working or it's hard to pump. They're not doing the best they can. They have a brand new baby. They're already not even doing the best they can. You know, I'm like the, made it 4 weeks. Made it 5 weeks. I can't believe it. And all I want to say back to her is, I swear to God, I was doing the best I could. That's all I want to say is, I was doing the best I could. Like, I was really, like, doing the best I could. And I remember, I've learned to totally dislike that artist just because of what happened on the way there. I can't even hear the music because I'm like, that's a sewer rat soundtrack. I'm like, I can't. I couldn't believe it. I had turned into that little rat. I was like, no, I'm the good rat. And I was like, oh my God. I was doing the best I could. So what's interesting is I went back to Diana. I shared this revelation with her. I think therapists get paid because they don't do that. I told you so, you crazy person. Look. She's like, that sounds like important learning for you. I told her what happened because a week after that, I find myself in West Texas, which is not far from here, actually, in West Texas with 40 deacons from the Episcopal Church who are deacons in rural West Texas. I mean, they have this incredibly difficult job. And so I do this exercise with them, which was really powerful, and I want to do it with you, see if we can do it. You don't have to write it down. I ask them, and I'm going to ask you, think of someone in your life who makes you crazy. Like, who's someone who you just cannot stay out of judgment with. It's better not to pick a child. It gets tricky. But someone in your life, I mean, everyone has somebody, right? You got that person? Siblings are always good. Parents work. Yeah, friends, neighbors. So what if God, or whoever you believe in, came and joined us right now and said, I am here to tell you, this person is doing the absolute best they can. What would be different for you? Tenderness. Compassion. Sadness. Empathy. Acceptance. Guilt. Guilt, for sure. Forgiveness. Patience. Disbelief. That's why God, only God can do it. Like, I really, like, only someone on high can do it. I know, because I'll tell you in a minute the story from West Point where I did this exercise. It was really interesting. So I had them write down this person. There was a couple probably in their mid-60s, both deacons. They wrote down the name of the same person. This was a guy named James who lived in a trailer in the desert, had 6 kids. 3 had been removed. 2 were under CPS investigation. Really hard story. Really desperate poverty, major family history of addiction. And so I said, tell us about James. And they're like, we're just, you know, it's like we go, we bring diapers, we bring formula, we do that kind of stuff. We check the next day, all that stuff's gone. They've got cash. They're gambling. Like, they're selling formula. They're selling, you know. And I said, tell me why you're crying. And the guy said, if God really came to me and said, James is doing the very best he can with what he has in this moment right now, it would only leave me 2 options. Stop dropping things off at James's house that can be sold for cash and help the kids directly and do that without judgment, or stop going to James's house and helping, period. And what I'm crying, I think, about is the massive amounts of judgment and hatred I drop off at that front door every time I drop off everything else and how it makes me feel every time I'm there. And so for me, I think Steve was right. I think it is hard to to assume people are doing the best they can. But I don't think we know. And the best they can is hard. You can really wrestle with it a little bit and say, well, does that mean they can never grow or change or be better? No, we can always grow and change and be better. But the question is, what would it mean for us if people were actually doing the best they could? And what does it really take to operate in our lives from a place like that? And so what I learned in the research was that it does require boundaries and integrity in order to be generous. And the reason why I think all of these slogans and companies that say assume positive intent is because they don't teach people the other piece of it is to love and live big is boundaries, integrity, and generosity. The most compassionate people I have interviewed in the past 15 years, and in fact, in the early data, I had a pile that was called my compassion smackdown pile. Like, oh my God, what do these people have in common? They're so compassionate. I thought it was going to be religion, spirituality, faith, inherent kindness, tragedy in their past. I didn't know what these people were going to have in common. But when we started digging, we found that they only had one thing in common. There was only one variable threaded through every single one of their life experiences. And you know what it was? Boundaries. The most compassionate people I have ever met and interviewed are by far the most boundaried, because it is impossible to extend an assumption of generosity to someone who is taking advantage of you, being disrespectful, hurting you, not hearing you, not seeing you. You cannot be generous toward those people. We can only be generous toward the people with whom we have set boundaries, demand boundaries, and we're able to stay in our integrity. And so it's easy for me to see in both of my stories that I've told today that I had no boundaries. The first time someone said, I guess you forgot the little people. And I said yes to something like, that's why my prayer is, you know, give me the strength and courage to delight in your will and walk in your way with gladness and singleness of heart. Like, don't let me do things that I'm resentful for doing. That's not fair to y'all. This is your time, and that's the most unrenewable resource we all have. You know, and so when they came back and said, oh, I guess you forgot the little people, I should have emailed back, which I would do today 100%, and I've probably done 100 times in the last few years since that happened, and said, I want to say that that's really hurtful and feels really inappropriate. I'm not able to do your event. I wish you luck, but I'm not going to let you talk to me that way. Period. Period. And if someone says you need to stay with a roommate, I'm going to say, I understand that that's how you do it. I'm going to need my own room. Because what I'm guessing is your expectation is for me to come and be 100% and give it all I have for your event. And in order to do that, I'm going to need to have my own room, sleep, have some healthy food, and probably do yoga. And I don't do those things with other people. So if you want me to come and be 100%, I'm going to need my own room. If that doesn't work, I completely understand, but that's non-negotiable. All best, Renee. Yeah, but it, oh man, how many of you are thinking, man, that gets up in the way I was raised? To be easy, to not ask for what you need, to suck it up, you know, that's hard for most of us. But that is the only way I think we can extend true compassion to other people is from a place where we are clear on my boundaries. You respect them. I'm clear on your boundaries. I am standing solidly in my integrity. And from here, I can be generous in my assumptions with you. So you say to me, this is an example I use all the time because it was a real example. Holiday party coming up. Really want you to come. The last two holiday parties, you drank a lot. You drank so much, in fact, that you were drunk. It felt scary for me. It felt really inappropriate in front of my kids. I would love for you to be here. I'm going to have to ask that you don't drink. Well, that's really none of your business. And I don't need you monitoring my alcohol. It is only my business because you're at my house. So the deal is, I'd love for you to come. I'm going to ask you not to drink. Uncomfortable? Yeah. Completely. Grown up? Double yeah. Because what is the alternative? To have someone come, get drunk, I'm anxious the whole time. I've been sober for 20 years. I mean, no, really, I don't, and my, you know, my husband drinks. My friends, the majority of my friends will have a couple of glasses of wine at a cocktail party. But if you're going to get drunk at a party, you're not going to get drunk at my house. You're not going to get drunk in front of my children, and you're not going to do it in front of me. Period. It's easy. Because the alternative is, I'm already pissed off when I see you at the front door. I'm talking about you behind your back, right? I'm trying to do the whole control your liquor kind of thing, instead of enjoying my party. So where are the boundaries? There are none. Am I standing in my integrity? Zero. So I am never going to be generous to you and never think you're doing the best you can. But from this boundary kind of integrity place, I believe you're doing the best you can. Been there. You just can't do it in my house. And that's hard. And so I was at West Point, asked a group of officers, special forces officers, to do the same exercise. All had served, all had lost troops, and we're back. And I said, let me give you a hypothesis. What if God came down and said people are doing the best they can? And this guy, I remember, was just locked on me. He was like, I need proof of the intel. And I said, I'm going to have to ask you to suspend disbelief for a minute. I'm just going to have to ask you to believe that. And he said that the person he pictured was someone who'd worked for him for the past year. And he had tried every way possible to get this guy to change some behaviors and change his work product. And he just could not meet the task. So I said, I'm going to have to ask you to believe that this person is doing the best they can. And he just got really teary-eyed. And he said, there's only one answer, ma'am. I said, what is it? And he said, move the rock. I said, what do you mean, move the rock? And he said, every day I get to work, I kick the rock, I push the rock, I shove the rock, I cajole the rock. But I'm just going to have to move the rock. And he said, and if it's true, I have mistreated the rock. Because I have a feeling if he's really doing the best he can, he's a good guy, really wants to serve, really committed, he's in the wrong job and he's not making a contribution here, and I got to stop kicking him every day and move him to a position where he can make a contribution. I got to move the rock. And that's the power of this, right? That's the power of this. It's not that you can't help people change and grow. It's that at some point you have to say, maybe these people aren't trying to piss me off on purpose. But when I asked you what emotions get in the way, you said all the right ones. You know, like if we have a parent, or I remember interviewing a woman who was talking about her sister, and she said, I would never believe my sister's doing the best she can. We came from the same parents. I know what we came from. It was really pretty great. And now she is working in a strip joint, doing this work. She is not, and she has a young daughter. She is not doing the best she can. And I said, what if she were? And she said, I will never believe that. Because it is better for me to be pissed off than start grieving the fact that she's not going to be the sister I need her to be. Because that means I have to take care of my parents by myself. So grief gets in the way. Fear gets in the way. Perfectionism gets in the way. But what I would offer to you is that it is a better way to move through our lives. To assume that people are doing the best they can and to give them an assumption of positive intent. If Tammy and I are working on something and we've got a big project and we've got really hard, you know, drop dead due dates and I miss one and Tammy calls me and the first thing out of her mouth is, Jesus, what were you thinking? You knew if we missed this date, we would never get this thing in time. And she said, I got a call that we missed a date. Help me understand what's going on. And assumes positive intent from the beginning. There's no way that can go bad, because if I say, you know what happened? They actually moved that date, and I didn't even hear about it until they called me. They have an email out, so they moved the date to next Thursday because they've got another project they're in, so it's great. We'll have two more days. I'm sorry I didn't give you a heads up. We're good. If I said, oh, my God, was that yesterday? She's still in her integrity. She can still draw her boundaries, but she's not now on the outside of her integrity. Because she started this phone call with, what the hell were you thinking? What I would say in terms of rising strong as a spiritual practice is, this is a spiritual practice that is a true call to courage. To say I'm willing, I want to be generous in my hypothesis towards people's actions, behaviors, and words. I want to live like that. But in order to do that, I have to be very clear with the people around me. what's okay and what's not okay. I have to set the boundaries. And I have to choose, I don't have my ring on. I have a ring that has spinners, but I can't ever wear it when I'm being recorded because it jingles. But I have a spinner ring that I bought myself probably 3 weeks after the Des Moines trip when I was starting on my perfectionism work. And so anytime someone asks me to do something, I spin it 3 times. And my mantra is choose discomfort over resentment. Choose discomfort over resentment. Choose discomfort over resentment. Because it's usually about literally 10 seconds of discomfort to say no. And what you get back is 6 months of resentment, right? For those of you who are any George Strait fans, yes, Texas, of course. I love George Strait. So one of my little secret things, I never talk about this either, but it's just us and whoever's listening in the future. So Amarillo by Morning, right? There's a line in that says, I'll be looking for 8 when they pull the gate, because he's a bull rider. And so anytime something hard's happening, I'm always like, look for 8 while they pull the gate. Look for 8. So I can make it through 8 seconds. I just count out my 8 seconds. It's like, if they can ride a bull, I can wait 8 seconds and say no. So I'm always looking for 8 when they pull the gate. So, you know, Brene, can you be the room mother? Okay. No. You know, look for 8 when they pull the gate. And related to boundaries and integrity and generosity is grief. This is one of the most difficult parts of the rumble, is I think the only emotion that may tie with shame for things we don't ever want to talk about or acknowledge is grief. We just live in a culture that has zero tolerance for grief. Really zero tolerance for grief. And I, you know, I was trying to look for the hallmarks of grief. Like, what are those pieces of grief? And I came up with these three in the research. Grief is about longing, it's about loss, and it's about feeling lost. And we can grieve for very small things. How many of you know what that sense of longing feels like? Like, I can tell you the sense of longing for me, it's the best example I can give you, is I have every time I drive to San Antonio from Houston, you take I-10 all the way, every time I drive in, you drive through the south side of San Antonio, and I pass New Braunfels Road where my grandmother lived. And every time I have this deep sense of longing to go somewhere that doesn't exist anymore. To be homesick for a place that is no longer is a really hard sense of longing. Like I just, and it's hard to describe it because it's a part of grief, but it doesn't ever go away. And it is literally a yearning. It's a, I want to go and have crappy instant iced tea in these brown plastic cups from Ace Restaurant Supply with Sweet 10. Do you remember Sweet 10 before any of the other fake sweeteners? I'm sure it's like off the market for horrible reasons. But, you know, and sit in her backyard and listen to the birds. That's what I want to do. And I long for that. It's like it's not cognitive. It's from my body that I long for that. And that's a part of grief. And then loss. Just an empty space. And then feeling lost. And I think that all of these feelings combined to make grief are, like I can tell you right now, and I know this is being recorded for later use, but I'm afraid that this will be a perpetual issue. Democrat, Republican, Independent, Green Party, whatever, I grieve for our country right now. I grieve. And grief is hard because a hard, tricky part of grief is nostalgia. And sometimes we grieve for something that never existed, but I'm pretty sure I'm grieving for something that did exist and is gone, which is just civil discourse and respectful dialogue. You know, like it's just gone. And I grieve for us a little bit. And the thing about grief in a culture that does not accept sadness, does not accept being lost or longing, is that the only emotion that is acceptable when you're feeling this is anger. We accept anger. We accept fear. And other than that, you need to take all of this and hide it. And the problem is that the way we're wired, whether we hide our grief or not, our body will always forcefully move toward it because we need it. It's the price we pay for loving. You know, people always say, I don't understand why you talk about the courageous being the most heartbroken among us. And I'm like, because it's so easy, because you have the courage to love. Like, you love anything or anyone ever, you will get your heart broken. And we think of heartbreak as someone broke up with me or filed for divorce or left me or betrayed me. But, you know, when our parents die, we just lost our first parent this year. That's heartbreak. And there are people, and more than there used to be. I mean, I started this research 6 months before 9/11, which is just the weirdest timing you can imagine. So I've been able to really see in the data and in people's faces and eyes how fear has just grabbed us by the neck and changed who we are over the last decade. Like, we are not the same group of people I interviewed in the beginning. And what makes that so difficult is that we are really wired to be brave with our lives. Courage and loss and grief, they're reminders that we're alive. They hurt, but they remind us that we're alive. And so we don't want to feel the hurt anymore. And so we numb it. And we numb it with everything you can imagine. But what happens when you numb the hurt and you numb the grief is you numb the joy and you numb the light. You cannot selectively numb affect. We know that. We know that in people in early recovery from alcohol addiction and drug addiction, people who have numbed, that an intensely joyful experience is as likely to cause relapse as an intensely painful experience. Because when you numb it all. So you numb grief, we numb grief, and we culturally numb grief. Like, this scarcity that we're in as a culture, this whole idea that you wake up in the morning, the first two questions you have are, what am I supposed to be terrified of today and whose fault is it? I mean, that's what we ask, right? Every morning. Scarcity is a collective form of post-traumatic stress. That's the way our country deals with what we've been through. And we've been through a lot. And it's not just 9/11. It's the recessions of 2008. It's changes around globalization. It's the environment. I mean, we've been through a lot. And rather than having collective grief and collective longing and collective loss and the acknowledgement of collectively feeling lost, we numb that. And so we numb our joy too. And so we're just there feeling no sharp points of anything, good or bad. And then that's when we start to question if we're alive. Miriam Greenspan, the feminist therapy is one of her big contributions, talks about it leads to, you've got all these numb people, it leads to what we call emotional pornography. Like, the only way you can actually tap into something, it is so overboard. It's so crazy. It's so, the murder mystery has three people getting the back of their heads blown off and you can see it in HD. Like, we can't respond to anything anymore until it's so over the top because we're so numbed at so many layers. You know, and so the only way we make it back from there is to acknowledge grief. That grief is hard. That sadness is hard, that fear is real, and that the most courageous among us will be brokenhearted because we had the courage to love. The most engaged among us will know disappointment because we had the courage to care. The most creative and innovative among us will always fail because we tried. And so I think that's the hard news. The good news is we are at the most ultimate tipping point I've seen since I started this relationship with my data, this research. It's true. It's there. That's Freudian. As an introvert like me, data, date night. I get really excited. But since I started this research, I've never seen us collectively so sick and tired of being afraid. We're tired of being afraid. And I think what we're starting to realize is fear costs more than grief. And I personally believe that when someone tries to lead us from, change our minds about, or get our attention using fear, no matter who it is, why it is, whether it's in church, home, politicians, we should be deeply, deeply insulted. Because we are better than that. And it would be really great moving forward if the people who want to lead us get our attention by being courageous. Because that's what we want to see. I think what we want to see is we want to see courage. We want to see integrity. And we want to see people being held to the same standards we hold ourselves. And I don't think that's a lot to ask. But I think we're at the end of a long, hard road right now. And I don't think it's the end. I think we've still got a couple of big ass potholes, in front of us. But I think if we handle them with courage and aliveness, even if feeling means feeling hard stuff, I think we can do it. And I think we're wired for it. What we're not wired for is to feel nothing. That's not human. That's not part of our spirit. Which leads to this, Christmas, forgiveness. That's hard. So, what'd you say? Let's skip this one. There's been an audience request to skip this topic. All in favor? Yeah. You know, I have never written about forgiveness until Rising Strong. Because I could never get the data to saturate. I could never get the data saturated. In fact, I came closest with the gifts, and I thought I really had it. You know who took it and said, this does not ring true for us? A small group of rabbis who I asked to look at it and say, what do you think? And they said, it doesn't ring for us the way your other research rings for us. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, it's too prescriptive, and in a prescriptive way, it doesn't match with the way we talk about forgiveness, and your research is usually under this. It's down here. It's about what forgiveness means to be human, not up here about the way different people, different faiths, different approaches to forgiveness. So I was like, God, I cannot get to forgiveness. I cannot get it. And so it turns out I was asking the wrong question, and I found that out at church. I was sitting in adult education after church. So like we go to church and then the kids go to Sunday school and we go to adult education. And Joe Reynolds, who is my spiritual mentor and who was the dean at the cathedral where I went to church for a long time, he too is retired. I haven't to wear people out. He was doing a talk on forgiveness and he said something. I remember gasping audibly because Steve was sitting next to me and he was like, people heard that. That was out loud. Joe said, in order for forgiveness to happen, something has to die. And I was like, in order for forgiveness to die, that's when I gasped. And then I kind of kept listening, but I got my, you know, I have a moleskin out and I was like writing. And I was like, man, right. And I was like, well, there's a Christian narrative for sure there because you've got, you know, the resurrection and you've got the cross story and you've got, but there's something there. There's something below the prescriptive nature of how people of different faiths, beliefs, cultures, genders, there's something there. And so I started digging back into the forgiveness research. And what I didn't even ask about or look for, because I didn't know it, to even look for it or ask for it, is the role that grief plays in forgiveness. And so I started asking people and interviewing people about forgiveness and the hardest parts of forgiveness and the beauty of forgiveness and the promise of forgiveness. And then it became very clear that in order for forgiveness to happen, including my focus group of rabbis, something has to die. So forgiveness is about death and rebirth, and not the Christian story of death and rebirth, just the human story of death and rebirth. And so the story that Joe was telling when he said this was about a couple that he was working with from the church he had been in 10 years prior to being with us in Houston. And that the guy had had an affair. They did not think they would be able to stay in the marriage because while he was sorry and he had a lot of a regret and wanted to make amends and really wanted to change things, she was so angry and was not able to forgive. And he kept saying, I wanted to forgive and things to be the same. And Joe was like, that does not how forgiveness works. I need to know, what is it that you're willing to kill and bury and grieve? What has died that will never come back as a result of what happened? And he's like, that will be your only way through. And so she started thinking, trust, hope, a picture of who we are. These things are dead now. We can grow new ones, but those are gone. And so this question of grief as the biggest barrier to forgiveness, because if I can hold on to self-righteousness, if I can hold on to anger, if I can hold on, and there are a lot of people who believe, in fact, I'm getting ready to do a class. It's like a dream come true for me. I'm getting ready to do a course with Harriet Lerner on her new book on apologizing. She actually doesn't think forgiveness is a good idea all the time. She thinks that people get pushed to forgive and they shouldn't. I'm a huge fan of Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and his book on forgiveness is the most powerful thing I've ever read in my life. He wrote it with his daughter, who's also Reverend Tutu. And he talks about how forgiveness is not an altruistic move. It's a self-care move about detaching yourself from the perpetrator of hurt. And so I don't know how I feel yet about whether forgiveness is an important thing every time for every reason. What I do know for sure from the data, and I don't like it because this is a hard topic, but I do believe something's got to die for us to forgive. I believe there has to be a death and a rebirth for something new. And I think that's one of the biggest reasons we do not extend generosity toward people, is that the moment I say, maybe my parent is really doing the best he can, and instead of waiting for him to pick up the phone and call me or come visit me, maybe what I have to say is, if you want to be in relationship, this is his very best, and you're going to have to do the majority of the connecting. But in order for me to say that, I may have to forgive, and I may have to grieve, and that's hard work. And it's not work we're great at, because we don't live in a culture that supports it. So to me, forgiveness is one of the hardest rumbles. I think the other rumble, very much tied to forgiveness, is compassion. And this is the definition of compassion that I have. And I want to address a question I get a lot in my research. This is the definition I use for compassion. Recognizing the light and dark in our shared humanity, we commit to practicing loving kindness with ourselves and others in the face of suffering. Recognizing the light and dark in our shared humanity. This is the struggle with compassion. Compassion is not a default response, because in order to practice compassion, you have to be able to recognize the darkness in you and in other people. And to me, this is the gift of middle age. It really is. This is the gift of middle age. If you come at me and you are all unicorns and bows and lightness, you scare me. Like, you know, we went back to this idea of rising strong. The revolution is an integration. Integration is probably the most important developmental milestone that we have to work through in midlife. It is, I call it Brené's home for wayward girls. I have to bring back all those versions of myself into one integrated self. I remember when I first started going to church, I went and bought like 4 outfits. And we went back for the same reasons a lot of people go back. We had kids, and I went to Catholic school, so they were raised without any kind of literacy around religion. And we're like, geez, do you think we need to go back to church? Do they go to Sunday school? But I remember going to like Talbot's, and I bought like 5 outfits. And Steve would say, you walk so funny at communion, because I was like, you know, because that's who I was supposed to be. You wear that to church, like a little pantsuit or something. And so I remember thinking, I can't go back and be in church and do these things and be myself. And I remember this whole integration piece of, look, all my girls are going with me to church. You know, my 1980s, crazy, hard drinking, hard living, Harley, back of Harley riding, that girl's coming to church with me. My perfect mom is coming to church with me. My, you know, all these people are coming with me. And that's a big piece. And it's dark and it's light. And that is what shared humanity is. And that's what compassion is. I love Pema Chodron says, compassion is knowing your darkness well enough that you can sit in the dark with others. Isn't that beautiful? Knowing your darkness well enough that you can sit in the dark with others. And so many times what we think of compassion is I see you and you're suffering. So the first thing I'm going to do is flip on as many lights as I can flip on. That's not about being compassionate with you. That's about my own discomfort of sitting in the dark with you. You know, and so I don't think until we can recognize that, yeah, there's a pretty gritty underbelly on all of us. And that that's what it means to be human. And hopefully we don't act from it and hopefully we understand it. But to me, that's a big piece of what compassion is. And if you don't know your darkness, like I always like to say, if you don't have a good stripe on you, like a candy cane, little light, little dark, I don't know that you can do that. People ask me all the time about empathy and the difference between empathy and compassion. And I think compassion is a commitment and a spiritual practice. I think empathy is a tool. And I think empathy is the greatest tool of compassion. Empathy is a skill set. I can teach you empathy. I've taught it in a master's social work program for 20 years. You can teach empathy. It is actually four separate skill sets that come together to make empathy. It's staying out of judgment. It's perspective taking, identifying emotion in others, and articulating an identified emotion. I mean, it's a skill set. It's not a spiritual practice. It's a tool. I think compassion is the spiritual practice, but I think it's very hard to articulate compassion for people if you don't have some empathy skills. And I think it really does a disservice to people if we don't think it's okay to have a part of compassion that's teachable. We just expect people to show up and be compassionate, but that's like saying to me, hey, the pilot's passed out. You have a lot of frequent flyer miles. Can you take over? Frequent flyer miles, the number of those do not equate to pilot's license. A deep compassion for humanity does not always equate to the ability to articulate that. And you know how when we were talking about there are not three emotions that we need to know, there are 30? That has huge ramifications for empathy and self-compassion. Because if Tammy and I are in a room and empathy is, I take her perspective, I stay out of judgment, I recognize emotion in her and communicate my understanding of that emotion, and all I can draw from in my toolbox is three emotions, that's tough. So empathy and self-compassion rely heavily on what I would call emotional literacy. And we don't do that, right? We don't teach that. We're putting something together now to teach kids, to teach parents and then to teach parents, let them teach kids. So I think there's a real difference between empathy and compassion. The last thing that I'm going to leave you with is kind of those shitty first drafts we talked about. There are three stories that we make up that I think are the most dangerous universal stories that we make up. And those three are stories that question our lovability, our creativity, and our divinity. Just because someone did not have the ability, the capacity, or the willingness to love us has nothing to do with our lovability. Zero. So when we make up stories that call into question our lovability because of experiences we had with someone who couldn't love us, that is a profoundly dangerous story. The second one is our creativity. 85% of men and women we've interviewed over the last 15 years can remember a story from school that was so shaming it changed how they thought of themselves as learners. 50% of those stories were around creativity, writing, or art. Unused creativity, the whole idea that you're not a creative person. Oh yeah, that's fun. I used to be that person too. Like my whole mantra was, you know, Brene, you want to go scrapbook or you want to go this photo? I'm like, that's cute. You go do your ART. I have a JOB. You have fun with your stuff. That was my whole approach. And as it turns out, unused creativity is not benign. It metastasizes and turns into grief and shame and judgment and hard things. Because someone did not put value on our work does not change the worthiness of that work or us. So the stories we make up about our creativity are very dangerous. And the last is really about our divinity. There is no person, church,